668, Nyack versus Columbus Board of Trustees of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. Mr. Nyack?
Yes.
You may proceed. You have 15 minutes.
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
Okay.
May it please the Court, my name is Robert Nyack. I'm appearing pro se. The issue presented here is whether a library board of trustees has been authorized by the legislature to make police power health and safety regulations. In particular, has been authorized to require that its patrons to wear shoes, supposedly protect those patrons from their own bad judgment. I'd like to begin by mentioning two items from the record in the federal case. These are both incident reports. In one of them, a little barefoot girl had a door open in front of her and catch her toenail and tear it slightly. The EMTs that responded called the injury not serious. In another one, a woman wearing either shoes or sandals also got her foot caught underneath the door, an open door. Her foot was cut and possibly even broken. Now, when looking for a rational basis for rules, the library could either, using these injury reports, ban wearing shoes or ban not wearing shoes. Or, as I cited in my reply brief, there are a number of cases where women wearing high heels have gotten their heels caught in various things and they may have been injured. Once again, the library could use that as a rational basis to ban high heels in the library. And this brings us to the core of the case. How is the library to decide what to ban? What guidelines or standards are they to use? And what is the legislative intent in this area? First of all, it's axiomatic that the legislative power belongs only to the legislature and that any administrative rulemaking needs guidelines or standards. And in fact, it goes further than that. There must be a clearly stated policy statement in order to have rulemaking and intelligible principles. Without that, it's a usurpation of the legislative power. This policy statement is not optional. As Berger Brewing said, even without standards, there must be a discernible public policy declaration. DABE mentions that all rulemakers can do is develop and administer policy already established by the General Assembly. This is required. Furthermore, they go on to say that in case of doubt as to a grant of power, the presumption is against such a grant.
Mr. Reines,
yes.
If I may, did not the federal court, United States District Court, in your lawsuit there, make a determination with the same parties involved, you and the library board and so forth, make a determination that the regulation or rule or whatever you want to call it was reasonable, was rational, and was within the power of the library? And if I just ask you that question first, was not that their ruling?
Pretty close to it. All they needed to rule, though, for the First Amendment claims and 14th Amendment claims was whether the rule had a rational basis. Okay.
But my question is, did they make that ruling?
Yes. They said that the rule had a rational basis.
Now, however, does not the rule of res judicata, that is, something has been decided, apply as to claims which were or could have been raised by the same parties in prior litigation, claims arising out of the incident or issue?
I understand.
Excuse me.
They never actually ruled on whether the library had the authority to make the rule in the first place. Basically, the status of the law regarding rulemaking is a multi-tiered test. First, you must find out whether there's a policy statement. Then you have to find out whether there's guidelines or standards, but those are sometimes optional, as per mass. Only then do you look at reasonableness or whether there's a conflict with the statutory intent. Okay, so in this case, it doesn't really matter whether there was a rational basis for the rule or not. If the library has not been authorized to make such a rule, it can be as reasonable as possible, and it doesn't matter. For instance, I cited Jacobson in the trial court. That was the first ruling that said that vaccinations were acceptable. Okay, could the library decide that everybody who had to come into the library had to prove that they'd be vaccinated? It certainly passes rational basis. It certainly, I mean, I don't know how reasonable it would be, but it certainly passes rational basis. Okay, the question is whether that is the way the legislature wants the library to restrict their patrons. Okay? So there's no place in the revised code that supports the notion that the library has been granted the power to make police power regulations. The library has pointed to no such public policy declaration, and the trial court pointed to no public policy declaration. The only thing that's been pointed to is proper operation and management, or control and management. Without anything of substance, the presumption has to be against the grant of power. I already mentioned the multi-tiered approach. The library relies on Woodbridge for only the latter two. Okay? But Woodbridge only addressed reasonableness. The others were not at issue. Woodbridge was a lottery case, and there was a clear statutory authorization in that case. Quote, no right to a prize award shall be assignable. Okay? So, as I already stated, in this case, collateral estoppel or rational basis is irrelevant since we never reached that if the library has not been authorized. In particular, Gerber Brewing said in their case that because of the lack of authority that had been granted, the question of reasonableness was moved. The trial court found a broad plenary grant of power. This completely misses the point. It doesn't matter how broad or unambiguous the rulemaking statute is if there is no policy declaration supporting the rule. Regarding proper operation and management, the broader the interpretation required to support the rule, the more it's really an admission that there is no such policy statement. Are there any policy statements at all to support any kind of rulemaking by the libraries? I think there is. The whole gist of Chapter 3375 is to ensure essential library services to all the citizens of the state of Ohio. And that's actually said in 3375.82 regarding grants by the state library. So to restate, the policy is to provide service, not to deny service. All of the existing library rules, with the exception of the Barefoot Rule, supports that policy principle. For when other patrons are interfering with the provision of the library service, then the rules restricted and are authorized. All other rules, except for the Barefoot Rule, and a couple of police power rules that have specific statutory authorization, fall into that category. But nowhere is a specific grant of police power. And the police power is special. The library is acting as if they have municipal home rule authority, that is, the power of local self-government and the power to make local police, sanitary, and other similar regulations. The Constitution distinguishes between the two. So does the statute on limited home rule townships. Proper operation and management describes local self-government, but has nothing to do with local police, sanitary, or similar regulations. I'd also like to revisit guidelines and standards. What is the reason for occasionally foregoing them? And that's expertise. But where's the library's expertise in health? Expertise in health is in the Columbus Health Department. And we have the affidavit from Morgan Condo that states there is no Department of Health regulation requiring shoes in any public building. The library also showed their lack of expertise in the Columbus Monthly article in which Patrick Levinsky, the executive director of the library, said, well, libraries are similar to museums, airports, and courthouses. As my affidavit show, I go to those sorts of places all the time barefoot. Okay, I use shops, all sorts of places. None of them have any sort of a rule. The library just doesn't know about this issue. The library also brings up the liability issue. But I think that's really just an end around for their lack of police power. Nowhere is it suggested in the Ohio Revised Code that this is the proper way to deal with liability issues. We also know that the library patrons are licensees for which the library need only refrain from wanton and willful conduct. Furthermore, as in my additional authority, the library has sovereign immunity to a large extent in everything except physical defects of the building. Ironically, when you look at the incident reports, the only injuries that seem to be related to physical defects of the building are people getting their feet caught underneath opening doors. Thus, the previous discussion on policy statement applies. Where is the policy that the way to deal with liability concerns is to exclude patrons? It's not there, and no other governmental body does this.
Mr. Nyhurst,
yes.
I apologize for interrupting you again, but it's a thought that comes to mind. You're objecting to a rule that requires shoes, and I don't mean to demean your argument by saying this.
Sure.
You probably know where I'm going. What if the rule said you must wear appropriate clothing in the sense of something that covers your body to some degree? You know, we don't want nudity in the would that be a reasonable regulation?
Three points on that.
And I don't want to divert you from your argument, but I just...
Absolutely. First of all, the library certainly could not be using their safety and liability excuse, okay? Second of all, let me distinguish, let's say the shirtless part, let me distinguish it. Bare skin on a chest, for instance, is something that we don't see every day, okay? However, the skin of a bare foot is completely exposed in flip-flops or sandals. So with bare feet, there's nothing new being shown that there might be for a shirtless patron. And finally, we don't really know whether that would be disruptive or not, whether that would be denying service to other patrons, which is what I say is the policy statement of 3375. Okay?
Again,
so the answer is, I don't really know at this point. We don't have facts before that would tell us. You know, you see sometimes women wearing halter tops, and that gets away with, you know, and that seems to be allowed. I'm not sure what the right answer is, but I think the disruptive standard would apply, because that's what the policy statement, the declared policy statement of the legislature is. Okay. Finally, I'd like to just address what are the practical effects if this rule removed. It would have no effect on the library. Evidence has been presented by me in my affidavits that it was not disruptive at all. I used the Runningsburg branch 20 times. Nobody ever even noticed me. That can be also in the interrogatories. I used the main branch. I was only even noticed a quarter of the time that I was there. And even then, sometimes it took an hour or so. I use the Pickerton Library. I use these museums, airports, courthouses. It really doesn't bother people. It's not disruptive. It causes no difficulty. If the rule...
How did this come up?
Pardon?
How did this come up?
Occasionally, a guard would see me and say, oh, we've got a rule against this. We've got to do something.
Did they let you in anyway?
No, then they would throw me out. And one point, I was actually officially evicted for a day.
You're about down to 3 minutes, Mr. Nyhurst.
Okay.
You can use them now or later.
Okay. In conclusion, Your Honors, during the library's argument, I shall be listening very carefully for any sort of policy declaration authorizing their police power rule, keeping in mind that when there is doubt as to the grant of power, the presumption is against the grant. Such a policy declaration is absolutely necessary. It is not optional, and it is not there. And as I listen, I will be keeping in mind that the broader the library wants its proper operation and management to be interpreted, the more they are admitting that no such policy declaration exists. Thus, I request that this court reverse the trial court's grant of summary judgment and remand with an order granting my motion for summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you. You've got 2 minutes and 22 seconds. All right.